In Empire and Underworld, Captivity in French Guiana, historian Miranda Spieler tells of the transformation of a slave plantation economy into a destination for metropolitan convicts in the 8 decades following the French Revolution. However, unlike British Australia, French Guiana failed to turn from penal colony to economically viable territory, and today remains a sparsely populated overseas department of France. The cover photograph of a forested riverbank shrouded in mist evokes the continual disappearance of human settlement. Spieler approaches this erasure not as a failure of French colonial policy, but rather as an expression and product of its design. Her book is a marvelous legal history that shows how the laws of empire produced a colonial topography, shaped its inhabitants, and played a decisive part in their ongoing destruction. In understanding laws and penal colonies as sites of experimentation, where new methods of subjugation and new subjectivities were produced, Spieler picks up Michel Foucault's seminal work of 1975, Discipline and Punish. Yet whereas Foucault saw the emergence of a disciplinary society in which the techniques of the prison were multiplied and scattered throughout, Spieler insists on the importance of certain spaces, certain targets, and certain laws. She insists on the importance of margins, borders, of non-citizens, and of the non-free. In short, she insists on the importance of colony in its imperial context to understanding the development of modern rights, laws, and space. In this way, she makes a significant contribution not only to the history of colonialism, but to central debates in social and critical theory. And it is in recognition of this achievement that her book won the George L. Mossa Prize for European Intellectual History and the J. Russell Major Prize for French History of the American Historical Society in 2013. In the following, you will hear an interesting interview that I recorded earlier today with Miranda, in which we discuss the relationship of these peculiar experiments in penal colonization and the history of race, of utopian thought, of revolution, and even of the relationship of this entire complex that her book explores to Guantanamo Bay and its peculiar legal system. Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Todd Weir. This week, it's my pleasure to speak with Miranda Spieler in Paris, who has just written a wonderful book, Empire and Underworld, Captivity in French Guiana. And first of all, let me welcome you to the show, Miranda.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Todd.
Great. And I'll ask you our traditional opening question, which is if you could tell the listeners a bit about how you arrived at your interest in this subject, what formative experiences you might have had that brought you to this work.
Well, like many people who now work on colonial history, I began as a French historian with an interest in the 18th century in the beginning. And so this project actually grew out of a curiosity about French Guiana, which was, as some people know, the scene of a major colonial disaster in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War, when 12,000 Alsatian peasants were conducted to their death in an apparently failed colonial scheme. But as I began to look at the place, it seemed that an awful lot of things had happened in French Guiana and very little had been written about it. And a lot of what the book is basically evolved out of a series of problems on the ground that I experienced when I started researching the topic, namely a lack of sources. And so a lot of what I grapple with in the book has to do with my own, these were attempts to resolve frustrations and obstacles that I encountered as I attempted to research a place that seemed to be the scene of a lot of things and very little written about. In terms of my formative experiences, I think looking back now, it was important that but right before graduate school and for a brief period in graduate school, I worked as an assistant to the writer Susan Sontag, who was interested in things concerning the visibility of suffering at the time. And perhaps as a way of thinking about the same topic from a different angle, I became interested in that same period in kinds of suffering that cannot be represented. And I think that that topic or that theme really shaped the project.
I wanted to just pick up on the question of sources, which you said presented a problem, and I think it actually turned into something that you turned to an advantage to make some interesting methodological claims. You write this book, and I want to congratulate you on the wonderful control of language that you have, and the way in which you create very clear and unique perspectives throughout this book. I think also rests with your strong choices in language. The book is quite removed from the subjects of this story. I mean, the prisoners, the slaves, the former slaves, and so on, and doesn't really allow for any identification with them. Yet at the same time, I think that the poetic tone that you have really allows a kind of intimacy to be created for the reader, which I found to be a very striking part of the experience of reading the book. But I'm curious about how, if you could say a little bit more about the problem of sources how did this change your approach to writing and to thinking about historical subjects?
Sure. There are a couple things I can say about that. First of all, the problem with sources differed depending on who I was talking about in the book. So when I'm talking about slaves and freed people, there were many more sources available, including there's a traditional range of sources, notarial documents and things like that, which allow you to access those kinds of subjects. And I use those in the book. The big problem for me was, on the one hand, an extremely mobile population of ex-convicts in metropolitan France, right, who don't live in villages that allow them to be accessed by traditional kinds of sources. And then in French Guiana, dealing with the same people who have been so stripped of their legal personalities that they actually can't be part of normal kinds of archives that people would consult when writing history from below. So my particular archival problems really differed in according to the group that I was writing about, but with respect to convicts, it was extreme. And so what I ended up having to do in that case was to really structure the book around the idea of the legal subject, to construct a different kind of subject whom I could track through legal acts and jurisprudence, but who was not always a single individual. And I think that actually allowed me to draw some useful connections between freed slaves and freed convicts and non-European immigrants, because I was looking at structures of law when I was analyzing the subject and not necessarily at individual people. I do want to say that I did hunt for scraps whenever I could. There is also another set of problems that I dealt with, because I was also very concerned about objectifying people who were undergoing forms of, violence and different kinds of subjugation. And I was very concerned that in a book with so few sources relevant to specific individuals, that I not fill the book with little morsels about people being hurt. That actually was a real concern. I did have documentation about people being beaten, for example, but I felt that this should not be the only way in which we got to know certain people from the past. And so it's true that I had to make some ethical choices about what kinds of things I should include when talking about people who were, you can call them marginal. It's just a way of saying that they were being hurt a lot. I took an approach that was on the one hand an attempt to solve a very acute archival problem with regard to people who can't buy or sell or marry or intrude themselves in any way into normal civil archives, but I also wanted to avoid using exclusively police documents or disciplinary files that would would depict the same individual exclusively through the eyes of the penal administration. So I tried to be protective in some way of the bodies of the people that I was writing about. And I also was really confronted by a lot of suffering in the book, and I felt that it was important to be unsentimental about the suffering. And so that may be, I think I hear something, some acknowledgement of that in the tone, about the tone, but it's certainly not an unemotional book. It's just a book that I tried to make unsentimental because of the magnitude of the suffering.
I wanted to talk briefly about the introduction, because it's through the introduction that we really learn, I think, how you are engaging with some key social political theorists of the 20th century. And it's really, it's a real aid to us in understanding your intervention in various debates. You mentioned Marc Bloch, Michel Foucault, Hannah Arendt as key figures, a few others as well, but I'll just mention those. And I think it's important for the listeners to bring in these figures in order to understand a bit about what your project is trying to do. I was thinking we could perhaps save Hannah Arendt for later in the discussion, but it might be useful at this point for you to mention Marc Bloch and Michel Foucault and how those two aspects of their thought have inspired this work. So maybe we could start actually with the Marc Bloch, since that's how you begin your book.
Sure. I begin there. Actually, I remember reading this book in a seminar led by Jacques Revel when I was working on my dissertation. And the book really became significant to me in a very practical way once I was in French Guiana. And this is because Marc Bloch talks about in what in English is translated as the historian's craft, I think, is that a way of interpreting physical evidence. And at that point in my project, when I finally went to French Guiana, I had really been struggling with the silence of the people that I was trying to study. And I had fancied that I would go to French Guiana and it would become clear through my study of the landscape. And I was thinking that Marc Bloch would provide a guide. So I actually had this book as a kind of guidebook to, I imagined that it was a sort of how-to guide for my project. And I got to French Guiana and confronted the fact very quickly that all of the places that I was reading about were more or less forests at this point. So in other words, rather than having a set of traces on the land that indicated a history of human settlement, like the way you would picture, say, fields in Picardy, I was confronted with secondary forest. And so I decided that I would trust Marc Bloch in a certain way and say, okay, well, what you have to explain is the construction of forest. and that I would regard, I would look for a way of analyzing how human settlement could produce an apparent wilderness. So rather than say, for example, thinking about the forest of French Guiana as a sign of colonial failure, which others have suggested, I decided to look at the forest in French Guiana as a human product. So that's actually, that was a very significant insight, at a relatively early stage in the project. I then had to figure out what kinds of structures could produce a wilderness. And that question led me to think that I should study law, which was, by the way, in the first wave and all, thinking a very vital part of the historical project. So I don't think that there was anything extremely surprising about setting the law, but I do think that at least when I started working on this project, it wasn't as central as it perhaps has since become to the way historians work on problems in colonial settings. In any case, so moving to Foucault, it's an obvious central person to engage with in a project of this kind. I should say that with respect to Foucault, the most obvious thing to say is that Foucault doesn't really engage the story of the penal colony. But I think that's a kind of it's kind of an unsatisfactory way of engaging with his work. So what I should say is that I felt that there was a tension between Foucault's work in Sauver et Punir and in his other work, certainly his lectures for the Collège de France about that are collected as Il faut défendre la société. And it seemed to me that on the one hand, Foucault in his more popular work wanted to argue for the emergence of something called the carceral archipelago, the sort of merging of the prison with the world through a variety of structures like orphanages and workhouses, and on the one so that and on the other hand, in his work in Il faut défendre la société, it seemed very much that there was a kind of internal mechanism of civil war that was continuously going on and resulting in the extreme marginalization or even extermination of certain groups. So ultimately, I argue in the book that we should opt for the Foucault of Il faut défendre la société in understanding the story of the penal colony. And to the extent that the carceral archipelago figures in the book, it does so in the final chapter of the book, which is entitled Metastasis, which is about how the colony of French Guiana, an apparently distinct place, became one with the penal colony in the second half of the 19th century.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just to go back to the Marc Bloch discussion, I mean, what I found interesting was the notion that you just expressed, that you wanted to investigate the forest as the product of this colonial legal system. And I thought it was wonderful because you, in a sense, there's a juxtaposition with a, let's say, a Whiggish history of Australia, which would be from penal colony to thriving economic colony, like as though this oppressive penal system was productive of something. Whereas in your reading, as I see it anyway, you know, the productivity of this penal system does not necessarily lie in its economic output.
Far from that.
Yeah, in a sense, the opposite. And that in a sense, the ghosts of all of these convicts and various unfree persons, evoke a different type of productivity, but it's not one that has a sort of Whiggish narrative attached to it. And I found that quite an interesting insight. And it also is something you could use, I suppose, to potentially criticize a Foucauldian understanding of power as being productive, because my sense is that in Foucault he sees power as a positive, productive force, and also its forms of domination and oppression. Whereas in your story, it doesn't necessarily seem that power, legal systems, incarceration are always productive.
They produce systems. I mean, I think it was productive of a complex system of domination. So that's what I was analyzing. Power is productive, but it produces. I mean, for me, the metaphor that sort of captures what I was trying to say about the place was happens when I was describing the beginnings of what becomes a penal town, which is called Saint-Laurent-de-Maroni, and it's on the banks of the Maroni River, and it subsequently becomes known as the kind of capital of the penal colony. And what what struck me in analyzing the documents relevant to the growth of the town in the 1860s was that all of the labor in this town went into the construction of the town. In other words, there was no emergence of free life. It was the continuous building of the town, you know, in which every building had bars on it. So certainly power produces something. It produces something enormous, but it produces a system of domination that's kind of chasing its tail. The story about Foucault definitely feeds in the story about what power produces with reference to the subject, you know, to what degree does power produce the subject is actually a good question with regard to this book. That was something that I thought about a lot, particularly when I was talking about people after slavery, freed slaves. And I felt that in the context of the 1850s, power in French Guiana, as it was being organized through the penal colony, bizarrely assisted the freed slave population in achieving a certain kind of autonomy, because they are relatively quickly becoming a propertied group. That they can acquire property. So in a sense, they achieve a certain status as legal subjects. But at the same time that happens, they are increasingly under the sort of administrative control of a penal apparatus, and also subject to a tremendous number of diseases that are killing people off, that are coming from prisoners who are not under quarantine. So I felt that power certainly produces something, but what it doesn't produce are lucrative estates.
Yes. I thought this is a great introduction. I think perhaps for the listeners, it'd be nice now to be introduced into some of the, you know, the sequence of these unfree persons who arrive in French Guiana. Each chapter, starting from the chapter dealing with the French Revolution, takes us really through a succession of populations, and you look at how legal systems emerge to deal with these populations, and then borrow from one another and evolve in an ongoing process. Could you take us through a few of these
sure.
populations, perhaps beginning really with the arrival of the enemies of the French Revolution?
Sure. Well, the book is organized as a study that starts in 1789 and goes to around 1870. So the first group of people that I deal with are enemies during the French Revolution, in particular the deportable group of priests. And in this kind of secondary move in that section of the book, I deal with the free black population of French Guiana during the same period. And the reason it's I need to do that is that the priests who are deported to French Guiana are deported to a colony where the slaves have just been emancipated and have nominally become citizens. When I move to the 19th century, I kind of set up the really large penal colony that takes shape then by trying to understand what kinds of people inspired the creation of that system. And so I start by analyzing the problem of the ex-convict in the early 19th century, and suggest that the invention of the penal colony under Louis Napoleon happened because of a desire not to move prisoners someplace, but to eliminate the group of people that prisoners become, namely ex-convicts. So I studied actually that group in some detail because I wanted to show to my readers that France was becoming a place that could no longer contain ex-convicts by the middle of the 19th century. And then I move to French Guiana to discuss events that are happening at the same time. Just as while France prepares to deport its hard labor prisoners to French Guiana, that very colony has just emancipated the slaves. So I try to deal with the problem of slave emancipation and other groups related to emancipated slaves in setting up the problem of the penal colony. And later chapters of the book try to deal with collision between prisoners, ex-convicts, freed slaves, and a few other groups of interest in the colony, including non-European immigrants, mainly from Africa, and also Maroon populations on the Maroni River who lived in proximity to penal settlements.
Very good. I'll come back to a few of those. I have some questions about those different groups. I wanted to mention you have a chapter on utopian social schemes and penal colonies, which is a fascinating chapter, and it's a good example of something that you really, I think, do throughout the book, which is create these often in one sentence these very sort of pithy, kind of almost think of like a dialectical image where you're connecting things that one wouldn't necessarily put together. These little ironic connections that are, made without any sarcasm whatsoever. I just give you one example I picked out of one chapter. You're talking about someone building a prison town, Ballanche. Ballanche discovered a method for perfecting society in the legal incapacity of convicts and in the Code Pénal du Bagne, the special law of the arsenal prison. So it's this notion that prison reformers could look to utopian schemes to get ideas for building prisons, or vice versa. Somebody with a utopian vision for the future might take something out of a penal system. Can you explain the context in Guyana, the story there?
Well, the context there it was very odd. He was very interested in the capacity. Well, what is it? In order to create a utopian scheme, basically, you have two options. You can actually move into nowhere, which is not possible, or you need a strategy for digging out a place in nearby that you can govern by laws of any kind you want, right? You can't create a perfect society using the laws of your own country, or at least so says a utopian. So you need to find a way of hollowing out some space so that you can rule it however you'd like. So what I was suggesting in that passage is that legal exceptionality, rather than being a troubling thing for Ballanche, right? A legally exceptional zone, far from being troubling for this utopian theorist, is ideal, because a legally exceptional system is a way of digging out space so that you can fill it up with something else. It's a way of creating a kind of legal bubble that you can fill with the perfect laws that you wish to apply there. And so when he looked to the Code Pénal de Bagne, it was because in France, in the prisons that the Navy set up in the ports of France, prisoners were not subject to the law of the land. They were subject to a completely different law created by the Navy. And so for that reason, Ballanche, the utopian, admired these prisons because they offered a model for how to dig out parts of your own country and fill them up with a different kind of law.
Well, that's also just a central theme of the book is the way in which these spaces are created in the Guyanese context that allows for these legal experiments. I think repeatedly, actually, you talk about these sort of almost nodules of exceptional law and so on.
I should say something about that, because it is true that the book does talk about legal exceptionality a lot, but I do want to say that I hoped that I called the meaning of legal exceptionality into question in the book, since what I tried to show was that a lot of things that start off as exceptional become normal and are normalized by the system. And so there isn't a really stable definition of what exception means.
Right. Well, you do a very nice job of moving from these naval prisons in France into Guyana and showing how these practices are brought over and transferred, moved, and so on. Also, you bring in the Algerian context at some point. Is there anything else that you draw out of this connection between social utopian thinking in the 1830s and the prisons beyond this utility of the prison as a zone in which one can introduce one's own laws?
Well, I guess you could probably say something about the way those kinds of ideas worked out with respect to colonial governance. For me, at least in the period after emancipation, the scramble from the administrative point of view becomes, how do you govern these new citizens in a way that will allow us to have powers over them that would not necessarily apply to citizens in France? And so early 19th century thinking about hollow spaces seems to me very important to understanding how post-emancipation society, in the French context at least, takes shape. So that's, particularly in the French Guiana context, there's a direct connection because it looks as though the penal colony is actually nourishing local ideas about how to govern freed slaves in the aftermath of emancipation.
Let's move to the question of race and slaves and so on. I mean, you talk about the threat posed by ex-convicts within France and the need to export this threat to Guyana, which is something I must say, even after reading the chapters, I still didn't entirely make sense to me why they were posed such an enormous threat. But maybe we can leave that aside. You talk about this fascinating group of former slaves or descendants of Dutch slaves, the Boni, who were a group of ex-slaves who then moved into the hinterland of Guyana and lived there. And they were in this French territory, or at least the French claimed this territory where they lived. Why did they pose such a threat? They were not a physical threat, were they?
No. I mean, they're not really a threat so much as an apparent reservoir of labor after the emancipation of the slaves, who then whom the French would like to control. There's also a lot of fantasy going on in the minds of these young lieutenants who are sent out by the Navy to French Guiana and wind up with the task of being camp guards. Those very people then sort of fancy themselves as explorers of the wilderness or, you know, discoverers of America and like to conquer peoples. So that's one element of what's going on in the period that I study, by which I mean the 1860s in that section of the book. One of the disturbing consequences of a desire for African labor after the emancipation of the slaves, combined with this desire to conquer peoples for the hell of it, was the effort by these young lieutenants from the Navy to dominate the Boni Maroons. Now, they failed to do that. I think that I make that clear, but they made an effort of luring Maroon peoples into the penal colony in the 1860s. And that effort largely collapsed because the French simply don't have command of the river, they can't navigate it. There are some natural obstacles to the French capacity to go and dominate the Boney Maroon. But the larger question of race in the book, which I think is a very good question, is connected to this. What I did try to argue in my analysis of the 19th century was that essentially there are French Guiana becomes a place that's really different from Martinique or Guadeloupe in the sense that those places are places where the master class remains after emancipation. And so there's a white elite that can kind of act as a control on the society. In French Guiana, both the poverty of the master class and the decision to move a penal colony there means that there's basically a complete flight of all but a handful of the whites, which makes the colony essentially too black for citizenship. And so that really makes French Guiana really quite a different place than Guadeloupe or Martinique. And it's grouped legally with colonies of what is sometimes called the Second French Empire, meaning Algeria, West Africa, and so forth, rather than being grouped with colonies that are slated for so-called assimilation to France. So race was very important to the sort of political history of this colony in the aftermath of emancipation. As for what race is, I do think that there's a racialization of the felon, which has nothing to do with the color of his skin in the early 19th century, and I think that that's pretty visible in the language in which felons are described. But of course, the felon is racialized as a kind of black person. Ways of thinking about people of African descent clearly inform ways of thinking about felons. That said, in French Guiana, there's a curious sort of difference between black criminals and white criminals and the way they're treated, where black criminals are okay to use as domestic servants, whereas white criminals seem to require isolation in unusual places. So on the ground, there are some interesting ways in which racial categories functioned.
Well, it's fascinating in your study, the way in which the processes of emancipation are always caught up with projects of re-enslavement. And you know, to my mind anyway, the problem of the freed slaves and the Boney I was wondering to what degree they are necessarily about their race. Could a black person be accepted as free, or did they have to constantly be denied full citizenship and subjectivity by the colonial state?
Yeah, I think there's a real difference. You're asking some good questions, and I hope I can come up with good answers to them. I think there's a real difference between the Creole population of French Guiana and the Boney people, because I think there's a sense in which the French administrators interpret their own colonial structures of domination as the equivalent of civilization. So in a sense, the Creole population, while black, has been subject to a form of civilization, whereas the Boney people have not been civilized, right? That's the way, and I think that those categories have unfortunate afterlife in the way, in the way people think about the Boney people. But in French Guiana, I mean, I think that there continues to be a kind of sense that the Boney are somehow culturally inferior. that aside, in the book, it really looks like there was a very different status that emerges for the Boney after emancipation. They're really not French, according to the way they're being defined, at least in the period I study. They are French with respect to the Dutch. They're French with respect to the English. But they have the status of what elsewhere in the empire would be called an indigène.
Indigène, you should translate that for me.
An indigenous person does not really have the same kind of connotation, because an indigène is really a colonial subject, a person with many fewer rights, who is often subject to a different kind of law. And I think it's significant in this case because even though the Boney people are discussed as French, they're discussed as French in a sense with respect to other countries. In other words, you would extradite a Boney from Suriname to French Guiana. But there's no sense in the period that I study that the Boney are French citizens with rights with respect to the other French citizens or the government.
I was curious to go back to that question of the productivity of this penal legal system. I mean, you definitely are writing a history both of unfreedom and freedom together.
Yes.
But you're not writing a history of, let's say, the productivity of unfreedom in the sense that, does unfreedom produce freedom? Does unfreedom is, in the sense almost of, let's say, a Marxist understanding of class, that the class system produces unfreedom for one class in order to enrich the other and to allow it to have freedom. There's a famous quote by a Berlin historian from the 19th century, Heinrich von Treitschke, and he said that there can be no culture without domestic servants, being essentially, he has to have servants or he can't produce great culture.
Right.
So that's one way of understanding the relationship of unfreedom and freedom, which again goes back to a kind of very productivist understanding. I don't think you have this functional view of unfreedom, and yet you do see it as tied to the system of freedom, in the sense of citizenship and legal rights and so on. So I just wanted to set that up and just to hear what you had to say about the relationship of unfreedom and freedom, also perhaps the center and the periphery of France and Guiana. That's
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's important to specify that when you use the word productivity, you're thinking about economic productivity or cultural productivity in a positive sense, like here's books, here's an orchestra, here's some musical pieces. And productivity in the book that I wrote is mostly about what the state produces. And I think that might be helpful. So with respect to the story of unfreedom, the book sort of traces a collapse between freedom and slavery. In earlier chapters of the book, I talk about the relationship between, say, citizenship and civil death, for example, as a meaningful opposition. And you could equally say that the opposition between freedom and slavery operated in the same period. Then it appears that in a variety of different domains, both in the story of the ex-convict in France and in the story of the colonial subject and in the story of the freed slave, a new kind of problem or figure appears. And I was looking at different embodiments of this figure, who is a person who is not a slave in the sense that there's nothing left to be emancipated from, but who can't get out. And of course, that isn't the case of every freed slave. I don't want to make, that's not my message. But in the cases that I study, I was particularly troubled by the way that a whole range of legal tools that either involved how to the instruments for governing pieces of land or instruments for dismantling the legal person managed to create profoundly unfree people in what seemed to be very modern ways. And that this seemed to be happening in a broad, in a relatively broad field of cases. So in domestic France, in various parts of the empire, in case of freed slaves and the so-called ancienne colonie or the old French empire, there took shape in the second half of the 19th century someone who was called free, but who was subject to various forms of exceptional law, who had a dismantled legal personality, and yet who could not appeal to for further freedom because there's nothing left to be freed from.
If we could, I wanted to bring in Hannah Arendt at this point, because, you know, in the introduction, you do spend a bit of time discussing Hannah Arendt and you're criticizing a certain notion that she has of, let's say, a kind of citizenship and the nation as a sort of almost citadel around which bad historical events have happened. And you have a nice quotation, which I'll just cite here. It is striking that Arendt feels obliged when writing of interwar refugees to attribute their predicament to the decline of the nation state, rather seeing their misfortune to arise from the nation state. Could you just say a little bit about Arendt, what your criticism is there, and perhaps sure. tied into our discussion about the relationship of freedom and unfreedom in, let's say, this historical period and in relationship to the nation state?
Okay. Well, in the part where I talk about Arendt, I talk about the part, well, what you just read from comes from the totalitarianism, but I also talk about I also draw on her work on the French Revolution, and this, more or less the same thing comes out of both of these works about different periods, which is that when she talks about violence and also the oppression of people, it's usually because of some kind of legal collapse. So, for example, when she uses examples of what it means to be to lose one's rights, she always talks about the stripping away of a legal personality to expose something like nature, something like a mere human or a slave. And similarly, the interwar refugee is a person who has been stripped of his legal personality. And she regards that as not as a legal problem, but as a problem about a failure of having, as a case of non-law, as opposed to a legal product. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me that a striking characteristic of Arendt's way of thinking about vulnerable people was that she insisted that the problem lay in lack of law rather than law. And so when I was making the point about the nation state, I was trying to say that we can think of these marginal people who had no rights as products of legal systems rather than people who are enjoying a predicament because of an absence of law relevant to them. And in the same way, I think we can think about homeless people, stateless people as legal products, not as people whose exposure to violence results from a lack of status.
Very good. Just as to bring things up to today, I was curious. You've obviously worked on this book in the aftermath of the establishment of an extra-legal territory in Guantanamo Bay, and the housing there of foreign fighters. Did that enter into your thinking about any of these topics?
I guess it made a lot of other people understand what I was talking about. The chief relevance was that I started mentioning things like I'm talking about the dismantling of the legal subject, I'm talking about these legal zones, and originally people didn't really know what I was talking about, and then at a certain moment it became clear that these sorts of problems had become commonplace. I should say that I think the case of Guantanamo for me is just part of a really long story, because those of us who study colonial empires know that the space of Guantanamo is a pretty obvious product of colonial style law. And so there are a lot of other instances of this that you could find in the past. I happen to study one. But rather than thinking of that as a kind of unique instance, I think that you can connect it to the story of colonial empires, bringing me to the point that if for those people who ask the question whether the United States is an imperial power, I would say that the answer lies in the legal structure in Guantanamo, among other things, because that legal structure connects our country to a much longer story about how colonial empires carve out territory to manage problems at home and also fill up empty places with exceptional laws.
Well, that sounds like an excellent place to stop our discussion. I think that sums up very well some of the key points that you've made in the book. So I just want to ask a last question, which is just to sort of look maybe in the future in terms of your own work. Do you want to tell us just a bit about what you may be working on now or what your next
Sure.
project's going to be?
So I'm working on a couple of things, but one thing that I'm working on right now is something about slaves living in Paris in the late 18th century. And in this project, I'm pretty much trying to reverse something that I talked about in my first book. So a lot of, as you mentioned, Todd, one of the things that I study in the book, Empire and Underworld, is how law moves overseas from metropolitan France into the colonies. And I thought it would be interesting for a second project to think about how, to what degree law moves out of the colonies and into metropolitan France. So one of the things that I'm exploring in the new project is the way, well, the question is, to what degree at the height of the French slave trade do French social and legal norms from the colonies move into France? And so the materials that I'm looking at there are legal old regime materials chiefly.
This sounds like a fascinating study.
Yeah, and the second project is sort of connected to the first one as well, in the sense that I'm exploring a facet of identity that I became very interested in while working on freed slaves and also convicts, in which is to say the name. So my entirely unrelated second, well, a sort of second new project has to do with naming rituals in the revolutionary era. And I'm looking at name changes and people losing names and so forth. And it's a way of trying to get at the human, what it means to be a subject, which is something I explored in the first book, just largely through what it means to have oneself dismantled. But in the new project on naming, I'm hoping to explore that from a different direction.
Well, those sound like fascinating projects. I look forward to reading them, especially the one about the names interests me, because I'm always curious with I mentioned revolutionary regimes and the importance of naming and name changing to revolution is quite a fascinating subject. So anyway, Miranda, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts. It was a very interesting discussion.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Todd. Thanks so much.